Welcome to Your New Mexico Government. I'm your host, Khalil A. Colonna. The title for this episode today is The Bitter Work. We're talking about the hard work people are facing when recognizing racism in themselves, others, and the system. There's nothing easy about what we are all tasked to do. It's difficult and uncomfortable, but if you were raised in the United States, you're already accustomed to being uncomfortable. Such unease should not stop you from doing the work needed today. My guests today are communications director in Washington, D.C., the founder of an inclusive leadership organization, a UNM professor, a community organizer, and we have part two of my conversation with my father. You can get the news update on the online version of the show. Just head to KUNM.org. We're going to jump right in. My next guest is Don Owens. He is the communications director for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law in Washington, D.C. And full disclosure, sophomore year of college, we were roommates. Don, thanks for being on the show, my man.
Khalil, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have been a communication director for many different organizations. You've worked with the ACLU. You've worked with lawmakers.
Yes.
There's been a lot of talk about we have to change policy, we have to change laws. Talk to me about why certain lawmakers and, you know, large institutions that delve into policy, why has it been so difficult for them to institute laws and policies that bring about more equanimity?
Well, I would say three words come to mind immediately. Moderation is one, and the other two are sacred cows. Speaking about moderation, I've had the pleasure of working in the personal offices for two members of Congress from the state of North Carolina, my home state, for rarely moderate to progressive areas. So the majority of the legislation that I've had the opportunity to work on and help advocate for have been things that have will improve the condition of the country, improve the condition of African Americans and communities of color and women as well. But I think the overwhelming reason why those pieces of legislation haven't had critical, widespread impact is because of political moderation. The belief of some in the Democratic Party that we should advocate for communities of color, but also at the end of the day, always someone warning, we can't go too far. So that's one part of it. Political moderation has slowed the process down. And I'm not talking about conservatives there. I'm talking about the progressives, the Democrats that I have worked for. We come up with great ideas, and at the last minute, when it's time to put the foot on the pedal, we ease up on the pedal. Second part is sacred cow. And that goes to the discussion that we can't have a bottom line, frank discussion about whether or not we should completely rethink and re-implement how policing is done in the United States of America.
What is that? It seems that progressives, Democrats in specific, have been almost in a way shooting themselves in the foot, fearing that should they take this step that is not very drastic, it's a major step, they feel that it's too drastic and people would reject that. And it's almost as if the question is, do you really want to make change or policy or do you want to get reelected?
Many Democrats in D.C. and in state capitals, we know there's a problem. We recognize we have the tools to address it and solve it. But by the time we get around to making the decision to do something, oh, wait, it's too late. And that usually, by the time it's too late, causes us to take the moderate position. And this all goes back to capitalism. But one of the drawbacks is that it only takes bold action for very wealthy people. But when we ask that same capitalistic system to take bold actions for those at the bottom and the middle, capitalism says, you know what? We can't take bold action for you, but you know what we do have for you? Moderation. And I think one last point, we've seen with the coronavirus and COVID-19 that the true folks who hold up this economy are those at the bottom. Because the minute they could not work, it wasn't billionaires who saved the economy. It was those folks who were working. And that's why those on the conservative side demanded and brought AR-15s and sidearms to rally, saying, we want those folks back to work because we see who holds up the economy and I'm tired of struggling.
What do you think about, well, one, the conservatives who showed up at these reopen rallies, and also the fact that we're having groups of, quote unquote, these armed people showing up at protests, standing around with their guns, being some sort of intimidation factor, claiming that they're there to protect property? What do you think about that?
We cannot deny the fact that law enforcement in the United States of America view certain Americans differently based on whether they are holding a weapon. I happen to be born an African-American male. If I walk down a street outside of D.C. carrying a legally licensed weapon, I am perceived as a threat. And that's why I agreed to do this interview, because your title of this interview, The Bitter Work, is so representative of what's wrong. We are not willing to do the bitter work that makes this country better. And the failure to do the bitter work has caused us to fail as a country.
That's right. He's the communication director for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Don Owens, my former roommate sophomore year. Thank you so much, my man, for your perspective, for your insight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Khalil. Keep up the bitter work.
My next guest is Kavya Esperanza. She is a community organizer for the Party for Socialism and Liberation, or called PSL, here in Albuquerque. Kavya, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Khalil.
So you've been speaking at many of these marches. What work is there in front of us to do right now?
We need to realize, as community members who are enraged and saddened by what has happened to Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd, we have to realize that these murders are not isolated incidents, because Black people have been murdered by the cops in the U.S. for years and years. This is a systematic problem. Racism is inherent to this system in the U.S. that was created by white slave owners. And I need the U.S. public to realize that the electoral system that we have in place right now was not created for people to assume power. It was always created so the capitalist ruling class can keep being in power, and I need people to realize this.
Now, you've been encouraging people to leave the Democratic and Republican parties to find a
Yes.
third party. Why is that?
The Democratic Party, just like the Republican Party, is run and owned by billionaires. That is the very bitter truth about this. The Democratic Party likes to present themselves as the more progressive option in the face of the Republican Party. But when we take a look at, for example, what the Democratic governors and other politicians have been doing during these times of riots and protests, we can clearly see they are not on the side of our people.
Now, the closest thing to a third party is the Libertarian Party. Have you all been in contact with them?
We have been in contact with them, and in New Mexico, we have had people from the Libertarian Party show up at our events and lend their support, and we have always appreciated that very, very much.
Now, it's an old trope, and you can say this trope was created by the establishment to scare people, so people often fear that they're throwing their vote away if they vote for a third party. How do you respond to that if someone is to say that to you when you're bringing them this option?
Well, if you are voting for a candidate that you do not fully believe in, you are throwing your vote away anyways. I mean, for example, the Democratic Party has been coming to us and telling us vote blue no matter who. And the option they give us is Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Joe Biden is a racist. Joe Biden is an architect of this mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex.
There is a considerable progressive wing in the Democratic Party, particularly in the House, led by new members such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Have you all reached out to these progressive members who she and other members have voiced their displeasure with the establishment? Have you reached out to them and say, hey, there are other options for you to run for office in?
Absolutely. Also on a local level, we have been reaching out to organizers and community members who are the more progressive Democrats, and some of them are willing to work with us and some of them are not, because the Democratic Party as a whole wants to cater to the billionaires' needs, the rich people's needs. So first of all, I believe that it is ridiculous, the notion of changing the Democratic Party from the inside. We have tried that for years and years, for decades, and it hasn't work.
You mentioned the protests. You mentioned this movement. There are thousands of people on the street, and it seems like this is going to be happening in perpetuity. How does this link and combine to voting?
I need people to realize, first of all, you have to vote in your local elections if you need any sort of change, because these protests, they are not happening just for George Floyd. They're happening against police brutality, and police brutality is not, again, an isolated thing. It is because Black neighborhoods have the money that come into education cut off. You know, some Black neighborhoods have not had clean water for years, even with a black president in office. So people need to really educate themselves on the people that they are voting for.
She is an organizer for the Party of Socialism and Liberation, PSL, in Albuquerque. Kavya Esperanza, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
My next guest is Melanie Yazzie. She is an assistant professor of Native American Studies and American Studies at UNM. Melanie, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me on.
What are the problems faced by Native people when it comes to police in the United States, especially in towns that border tribal lands?
What we're facing coming out of George Floyd's murder a week and a half ago is pervasive anti-blackness in this country. And I think the focus on defunding the police and police violence should rightly focus on our black relatives who experience the highest numbers, right, disproportionate numbers of police violence. That being said, in this region, simply because I think of demographics, there are a lot of Native people in border towns like Albuquerque, Gallup, Winslow, and Farmington. Native people also experience disproportionate numbers of police violence. A place like Gallup on any given day is about 50% Native. Other times when Native people are coming off the reservation to shop, it's more like 90%, right? Okay. So Native people are often in the majority in a lot of these spaces. If we understand kind of the ongoing settler colonial context, the relationship between Native people and the United States, we need to understand settler colonialism, which is essentially about the disappearance of Native people, the disappearance of Native presence in order to gain access to resources and land. And today, because Native people never actually went away, we were never disappeared successfully through the various genocidal projects that the United States tried to commit against our people, our presence really defies, right? It defies the logic that we're not supposed to be here. And so because we're not supposed to be here, we're seen as a constant threat. If we think about police as agents of the state, right? They uphold the law and order of the state. They're some of the frontline representatives of how the settler state views and sees and treats Native people. Then you can start to understand how Native people experience police.
You were in Gallup on Wednesday, and we heard that these militia groups were headed that way for the BLM protests there.
Oh, yes.
What did you see?
Oh, I've been thinking about it for a couple of days. Okay. I think I was in shock, actually, when I was on the ground. It basically felt like a military occupation. So even though there wasn't what we usually consider like military forces like the National Guard or the Army being deployed in these spaces, the people who were there instead were armed, kind of like patriot groups, kind of the anti-lockdown milieu, the Trump supporter folks. And so there were, I would say, at least 100, maybe a couple hundred armed, mostly white men who were protecting businesses. Lots of the businesses were boarded up. Everyone was carrying automatic weapons. There were civilian militiamen who were snipers on roofs of a lot of the downtown shops on Route 66. It's hard to tell sometimes the different militarized police forces who are on the ground in a place like New Mexico. There were a lot of them too. And so I would say there was a crowd of, you know, once we got to City Hall and downtown Gallup after the march, maybe like 75, mostly Native, some black folks and some white folks who were there kind of speaking out about police brutality and violence in Gallup. And we were surrounded by probably 300 or 400 heavily armed police and white militia.
That's a gratuitous display of intimidation.
Absolutely. A lot of the indigenous resistance in this region has actually been against white supremacist vigilante violence in border towns. And so what happened on Wednesday in Gallup, it's a continuation of what actually happens every day to Native people who are brutalized constantly. It's called Indian rolling. It's this kind of racist white supremacist, usually white men, who go out to try to roll Native people on the streets to kill them, to maim them, to kidnap them. And so what happened on Wednesday is, I think, just the flare up of that pervasive racism that Native people experience.
And so these groups are there claiming that they're there to protect property. Tell me about, what does their presence feel like? How did you feel when you saw all these hundreds of people there?
Nobody actually knew who called the action, and it was kind of word of mouth because I think people were really worried that they were going to get targeted in the same ways. It's been happening all over New Mexico that these quote-unquote armed patriots or whatever are showing up heavily militarized to quote-unquote protect private property. We made a last-minute decision to go simply because we were worried that the people who were going to be at the protest were going to get hurt. We had no doubt that they were gunning for Native blood in Gallup on Wednesday. They can act with impunity in broad daylight in a place like Gallup because anti-Indianism is so normalized and pervasive. A group of about 10 of us got in our cars and we drove to Gallup. And I tell you, we were the only thing between our Native and Black relatives and those armed militiamen and those police. And that feeling We kept our cool. We were very organized. We have been parts of actions where there was extreme confrontation with police. Everybody in Albuquerque knows that that happens all the time when you're doing street actions in the city, because the police violence is so extreme. And so we were prepared. They actually tactically surrounded us over the course of the hour and a half that we were at City Hall. And to top it off, there were mostly white folks who had actually set up their lawn chairs to watch, because they were actually hoping and expecting that we would be brutalized by those militias and those police. They actually said this to one of our comrades who was walking around. The whole week we have been hunted. The feeling is a feeling of being prey. That's what it has felt like.
Yeah, you laugh at it because it's so ridiculous, and to laugh at it to ease your soul and your heart. And, and I'm looking at the absurdity of their arguments. I want to ask you, and this is a very difficult question, because I don't know if we all know the answers to this. What work needs to be done to create a real type of change?
That, I think, is the question on everyone's mind who cares about people, cares about the future of humanity. The best direction we have right now is the trending hashtag defund police. Folks who might know about the Black radical tradition knows that the calls for abolition, right? The abolition of the police, the abolition of the U.S. military, that abolitionist politics, the abolition of slavery, right? That abolition is something that is tried and true. 2 weeks ago, some of us thought that it wasn't even possible to make abolitionist claims. We're like, everyday people are never going to get on board with this. It's too structural, right? Because we live in a country where we just do these like incremental reforms and we never really get anywhere. But today you're seeing millions of people who are on board with defunding the police. It's switched. It's switched in a week, which is fascinating to me to think historically how quickly the consciousness around abolition has changed.
She's an assistant professor at UNM, organizer and activist, Melanie Yazzie. Thank you so much for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
This is UNM Government. I'm your host, Khalil A. Colonna. We're covering life during the pandemic and how what's happening affects us all differently. Tune in Wednesday through Friday at 7 p.m. here on KUNM, or find every episode anywhere you get your podcasts. What's the work you have to do right now? We want to hear about it. Call up our hotline, leave a message, and we'll interview you. Call 505-218-7084 or email urnmgov@gmail.com. My next guest is Sean Levitt. He is the founder of Macklin's Inclusive Leadership. He's been working on diversity and inclusiveness for over 20 years. Sean, thanks for being with me, my friend.
It's great to be here. Thanks for asking.
So talk to me about the topic of implicit bias. That's something that's been coming up a lot when people are like, well, I don't know, I don't think I'm racist or bigoted in some way. But then the idea of implicit bias comes up. Can you explain to the audience what is that exactly?
Well, I think implicit bias is a blind spot that we might have that we're not aware of. And it's hard for us to admit that. You know, especially as white people, we've been taught that we should be living in a colorblind society. And there's really good intention behind that. But I think what happens all too often is we don't recognize that the way that we're behaving, the way that organizations get structured, the way that laws have been put on the books, that happens because of, sometimes it's clear bias, you know, it's explicit bias. But sometimes, you know, it's like implicit bias, and good people aren't aware that they're doing things that could be harmful to others. And we do have those biases because we've been brought up in a society, especially in the United States. You know, we've got this white patriarchal Christian history that has really shaped how many people have experienced this country. You know, we're taught really not to see differences and have those biases, because in a way that almost makes us bad. It's the good people that aren't recognizing their implicit bias or those blind spots that really need to do the work.
What are some questions? What's a good way people can check themselves to see if they have implicit biases and they're doing that?
I can tell you, Khalil, I've been doing this work for a long time, and I take it very seriously. I really try to ensure that I am checking my biases and managing them the best I can. And that's hard to do. That's the bitter work, because I don't think we can get rid of them. I think we can manage them, and that takes a lot of practice. And sometimes they slip. And when we see them slipping, then we have to move to that next step of doing the bitter work in checking the impact of that bias or behavior, mm-hmm. being open to some feedback and staying committed to that journey.
What type of conversations do you think people should be having right now? I mean, how do white people who believe that they're not racist begin to have a conversation with family members or friends who do not share their beliefs?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I lived it yesterday. Mm. You know, I'm fortunate that I have a parent and a mother in particular that is open to doing the work. And she and I do not always agree on things.
Yeah.
But what we've been able to do is create a space where we can have courageous conversations that are really hard. I had to recognize that I was coming into that conversation with some bias. And we have to recognize that there are, you know, multiple group identities that are in play when we're having these type of conversations. And there are some power dynamics and a hierarchy. So we've got differences between, you know, a parent and a child, differences, you know, in this case, between across gender, between me and my mom.
Mm-hmm.
We've got differences across educational level.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to check my bias and what I was bringing into that conversation so that I didn't shut things down and I didn't make assumptions. And
yeah.
So that takes awareness, that takes humility. It takes stepping into it and it being uncomfortable and messing up.
Yeah.
But like I told her, we got to keep having these conversations, even though they're hard,
mm-hmm.
Because I do believe they pay off. You know, I know we're going through a lot right now in this country in a lot of different ways. And we're hearing, you know, from protests. And I think we're hearing from, you know, those that are supportive of how the police are handling this and how some of the government officials are handling this. Polarization is just very, very clear.
Yeah.
The lines are very, very drawn, and
yeah.
we've got to find some middle ground that works for as many of us without discounting the reasons why people are out there protesting.
I want to thank you very much for coming on and having this conversation with me.
Thank you for all you're doing, Khalil.
That is Sean Levitt. He is the founder of Macklin's Inclusive Leadership. In yesterday's episode, we aired part one of a father-to-son conversation I had with my dad, Ademola Ekolona, who just retired as the program coordinator for a hospital-based violence intervention program in Baltimore and who was a Babalawo of the Yoruba tradition. In that conversation, we left with me describing the moment when we had the talk, not the birds and the bees, but how to conduct yourself when dealing with police as a young black man. Today, my father shares his experience growing up. Here's part two. He does most of the talking.
This was in the 1950s, so it was quite different. It was not even anything special at all. Just you have to know how to act. In my family, I'm fortunate that my family, maybe unknowingly, but definitely did, retain the African tradition of teaching the children that you have to be your own police. You are expected to control yourself so that you are not going to cause public disorder. And we had to learn that as black children growing up in the 1950s in Newark and certainly in Montclair. While we had the freedom to walk in Montclair, if you went to Caldwell, there was Montclair, and then right above it is Verona, a very small strip. Then there's Caldwell. Well, Caldwell was a sundown town.
Mm.
And any black person who had business in Caldwell had better get it done before sundown. Because this here in New Jersey, you are not to be in Caldwell after sundown. Now, this was in my lifetime, but this was a fundamental principle that African people had to learn as Americans. Now, that's in the North. You know what, though? Of course, you know, I've been studying our history and culture and reparations for years. I feel it's closer now than ever. I know that the biggest opposition to it, when it was considered back in the 1860s, they were saying, but look what we would have to do, how much this would cost. Well, they just invent money these days, as they did for the coronavirus. Those trillions of dollars that the Congress invented, they did not go to a vault and get that money. They put an account in place. And there is the secret. Because, you know, you remember when I was working corporate, when I was writing interactive scripts back in the 80s, man. I didn't realize now then that this was the beginning of something that was going to become really big business. Well, the stuff that y'all were fed with, the money I earned, was because I was able to work with white people. Often, very often, and I don't remember ever having another black person in the room or even in the building, let alone in the meeting.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I came to understand is that as one of my white business associates let me know, he said, you know, I've listened to our conversations when you are in the room, and I've also listened to our conversations when you are not in the room.
Mm.
And he said, what is said when you are not in the room would really shock and surprise you. I learned and understood, as my mother had taught me, you're going to meet white people one by one, so you got to know what to judge them one by one. I said, but there's so many of them. She said, but you're going to meet them one by one. And so if you have to deal with them, know who they are and where they're coming from and whether you can deal with them or not. We have to all look at how true are you to being a human being that recognizes other human beings as being worth the effort it takes to stand up for their rights? How true are you? I know that the big deal is going to be, how do the white males respond to this national moment? That's where my mother's one-on-one, one-by-one, that's where that comes into play. I'm so proud of you that you're able to be in the position where you can discuss these things and others can take part in the conversation. I'm glad that you're doing it. And I look at this generation. Wait a minute. What generation are you? Are you not the millennials?
No, I'm a Generation Xer.
Okay. The Generation X, and then after that is the millennial?
Yes.
And after that is the what?
Why?
Okay.
Or Generation Z, something like that.
Well, I'm telling you, the key difference I've seen is that Generation X and the millennials are not going to put up with the we had to put up with, because I was of the we shall overcome generation.
Yeah.
You know, we had to be dressed in white shirt and tie to go to the demonstration. Well, these young people, oh my God, they are not going to sit down and take easily the things that we took.
I want to thank you, Baba. I love you so much.
I love you too. Y'all have a good day. Keep going on.
We will. We want to hear your story. What's shaping you during this time of change? Call up our hotline, leave a message, and we may play your story on air. Call 505-218-7084 or email yournmgov@gmail.com. And we are on Facebook. Look for Your NMGov. It's about time for resources. Find a full list of the resources we talk about on each episode and opportunities to donate or help online at bit.ly/YNMGHub. If you want to educate yourself, check out the book Blind Spot, The Hidden Biases of Good People by Anthony Greenwald and Mazarin Banjai. Take a look at the work of Brian Stevenson, recommended by guest Sean Levitt at eij.org/Brian-Stevenson. If you want to get a gauge on your implicit biases, take the test at Project Implicit. Head to implicit.harvard.edu/implicit. Learn more about the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. Head to lawyerscommittee.org. And get info on the Party for Socialism and Liberation by heading to pslweb.org. Hear us now on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays on KUNM's airwaves at 7 p.m. You can always find the show on KUNM.org or subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. Your New Mexico Government is a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage is provided in part by the Thornburg Foundation, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, the New Mexico Local News Fund, and KUNM listeners like you. Your New Mexico Government is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco, theme music by Pope Yes, Yes, Y'all. It's produced by yours truly. Thanks to Taylor Velasquez and Kaveh Movahead for flexing their editing chops. Really appreciate it. For everyone here at Your New Mexico Government, I'm Khalil Ekolona. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. And let's be better humans, everybody.